The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jay Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
And let me, that would be Jay Query, illuminate for all of you who are loyal enough to listen to Beyond the Bricks each and every night or in podcast form. Let me illuminate for you what it looks like here inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. First off, you have Landon Coons, the pride of the University of Indianapolis, who mans the ship. That means he pushes the buttons, makes the proper edits, does all of the things necessary to keep us on track, and has a huge stopwatch letting us know when we are getting heavy and running too late on something. And in addition to that, what he is doing is he is orchestrating this interweave that takes place between myself and Mike Thompson. But in reality, it is Mike Thompson who is the one that is the George Bignotti of the group. It is Mike Thompson who is the one that is the Carl Fisher of the group. It is Mike Thompson who is the one that is the Eddie Rickenbacker or Tony Holman of the group. By that, I mean he has the vision, he has the equipment, he has the mechanical engineering, he has all of it to put together these programs, because Mike has a collection of audio of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and different things throughout racing that he then sits and pulls out different clips and thinks this would make for a good show. He passes them along to me, and I simply strap into the car, do two laps, come out and say, that sounded good. And then we do a show. So that's exactly how things work here at Beyond the Bricks. We thank you for listening to it each and every evening. And so without further ado, the man that is wearing all of the hats that make all of this possible is Mike Thompson. And Mike, I know that you have a lot of fun pulling these audio clips. Sometimes it is incredibly rare audio that we oftentimes are hearing for the first time that you've unearthed. And oftentimes it is audio that perhaps we've played before, but of key central figures that are so critical to the long-form story of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and auto racing in general, that it does merit playing over and over and reminding people who know of it and educating people who don't of the story of key figures of this, the greatest race in the world. And I think you could safely say that the world's most famous figure to have raced at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is the one that we will feature this evening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate all those accolades you gave me, although I will say that the people who think I have a big head as it is, I've now been, I've been compared to Carl Fisher and George Bignotti and, all these different people. So that's pretty heady company to be compared to in the beginning of this show. But I agree. When you talk about the person we're going to feature tonight, I was thinking about this when I was putting this show together last night. Is there a guy who's a better storyteller than the person we're featuring tonight, Jake? When I was thinking about, people who tell stories about their time in racing, this guy might be at the top of the list. I was thinking about this because he's so, not that other people aren't articulate and good storytellers, but this guy would be near the top of the list, if not the top of the list for me, because he's so good at telling stories and bringing you in and engaging you in the stories that he's telling. And I just thought about it last night. I was like, you know what? We need to do another one of these shows where, we let him talk in his own words about his career.
We're talking about a story that began on February the 28th of 1940 in the Kingdom of Italy. Now, there have been obviously changes in the map and things that have taken place over the last 80 plus years, but the story would then continue in the United States once his family would come to the eastern part of this country in his earlier years. He is probably at this point the greatest vocal ambassador for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and IndyCar racing, talking about none other than the guy that started 29 Indy 500s and is fourth in the all-time laps led list, 556 laps led. He has 11 top 10 finishes. He, of course, the winner of the 1969 Indianapolis 500, talking about Mario Andretti. And when you talk about Mario Andretti, Mike, it goes without saying, there are oh so many drivers today that would look at Mario Andretti, look at his career, look at his pop cultural relevance. Pop culture relevance, as we've talked about, he's in, you know, I go back to the movie Meet the Parents, you know, just when Ben Stiller's character is driving so fast and the guy says, you know, oh, nice driving, Mario. It's become literally a catchphrase in the American culture. So you can only imagine that there have to be drivers that looked up to Mario Andretti. But like anything else, Mario Andretti himself as a young man had to have a driver that he looked up to. And Mike, it is interesting to think that somewhere out there, there is or was someone racing who Mario Andretti would idolize, but that, of course, is exactly the case.
Definitely. And one of the things that was cool for me was getting a chance to ask Mario about his hero. And I like to do that when I'm doing these interviews. It's like, you know, who was your hero? Who was the guy that got you interested in racing? Because, you know, we all have those people. And Mario was one of mine. And actually, I set this up in the interview because, you know, there was a book that came out called What's It Like Out There. And I took this book out of the library at my junior high in Toledo so many times that, no joke, they actually did give me the book. They were sick of me taking the book out, and they were finally like, look, take this book because you take it out all the time. It's never in the library for other kids to take out, so you take it, you know. So, you know, he was a hero of mine growing up, and so I was thinking, well, you know, who was Mario's hero growing up? Who got him inspired to be in racing? And so that was one of the questions I had the opportunity to ask him.
Mario Andretti on those he looked up to.
When I was in junior high, my favorite book was What's It Like Out There. In fact, they gave it to me because I took it out of the library so many times. And one of my favorite chapters was when you were talking about living in Italy, and I learned about the great Ascari from you. Yeah. I didn't know Alberto Ascari until I read your book, and I learned about it. But what was so captivating about Ascari, and you and Aldo both wanted to be Ascari?
Well, what was captivating was the fact that at the time when I became enamored with the Formula One, of course, Ferrari being at the forefront, you know, Formula One, of course, and Maserati, Alfa Romeo, you know, being all these major brands, you know, part of Formula One. And then Alberto Ascari was world champion, you know, when I was a teenager, you know, at the early teens, you know, he was world champion 53, 54. Of course, you know, the world champion, everybody talks about him, and he looked cool. I love the way the press used to describe him, you know, like he had ice in his veins and all that. These are all the things that I think capture your imagination as a kid, and he was just a cool looking dude, you know, that you always figure, oh man, I want to be just like him when I grow up, type of thing.
And in terms of when that racing bug was caught, keep in mind Mario Andretti, of course, had a twin brother, Aldo Andretti. And when they came to the United States, like anything, you know, it was an interesting dynamic because Mario has told the story several times. His father was still learning English. Mario and Aldo were getting more acclimated to culture in the United States and the things in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, that one would do for fun. And for the two young twin boys, one of those things that they would do for fun was something they caught and noticed, a bug, as we call it, that they caught at a young age.
We arrived here in the United States in Nazareth on a Thursday. It was June Thursday, so the season was in full swing, you know, with the local stock car racing. And we were at my uncle's house, which was about maybe a mile and a half away from the fairgrounds. And it was on a Sunday night, and we're just there, just hanging out. And all of a sudden, we see bright lights in the background, you know, and we hear this roar of engines all of a sudden. And Aldo and I just looked at each other, and we just followed that noise, and then we just peeked through the fence there, and then we see these brute-looking modified stock cars. And, you know, the last race that we saw was the Grand Prix of Monza, you know, the Italian Grand Prix of Monza. And but again, I always keep saying, by looking at that, it looked very doable. Like, you know, all of a sudden, Aldo and I look at each other and say, man, you know, we could do this. Like, 2 years later, we started building a car just to race right there, you know, a stock car. We were 17 years old 2 years later, and then the objective was to race. By the time we reached 21, which in those days you had to be 21 to race legally, professionally, and but the car was done, was finished when we were 19, so we had to fudge our birthday on our license. We had a guy to do that for us, and then so all of a sudden we were 21, but 19.
Mike, the funny thing about it, I had mentioned the fact that perhaps, naturally speaking, I think when you talk about immigrants, it probably is safe to say that the younger generation, so the children, would begin picking up on things or acclimating faster than the parents, because you're in school, they say it's easier to learn another language at a young age, and other such things. So for Aldo and Mario, as they're learning about everything that is going on in terms of the entertainment racing, for example, around Nazareth, you know, their dad was a working man. So to a great extent, and I say this in a loving, as Mario would as well, in fun fashion, he and his brother, Mario and his twin brother Aldo, they were getting involved in some things that, not nefariously, but their father was unaware of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, their father didn't know that they were racing, and they weren't about to let him in on that secret. You know, that was a secret that they were definitely keeping from him, because, you know, he did not approve, and he made it clear that he didn't approve of racing. And you have to think about the times. I mean, the things that were going on in racing that time. I mean, it was obviously very dangerous. There were a lot of fatalities, and there had just been the big terrible accident at Le Mans that had killed a driver and many, I mean, dozens and dozens of spectators. And so you know, think about someone like Mario's father seeing that, you know, splashed on the front page of a paper, and then, you know, you hear your sons want to be involved in racing. You know, when, no, I don't want you involved in that. So, you know, they had to keep that secret from their father.
Mario Andretti on exactly that.
Well, you know, we didn't dare tell our dad because, you know, he was not up to speed on motor racing. But all he knew about was, you know, what the press always talked about, the fatalities, which, you know, were, you know, pretty much the order of the day in those times. And as you know, on the way over on a ship, that was during the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and that was the year when they had that horrible accident with Pierre Levesque, wound up in a grandstand killing 85 spectators. So those were the news that my dad knew about motor racing. And so whenever we would read about racing, he said, oh, you crazy kids. And there's no way that he would have really allowed us to even do it. So as you said, we our first season, we had to do it to protect ourselves. You know, we had to just not say anything to protect ourselves. It was actually the language barrier, quite honestly, because it took them a lot longer to learn English than we did. And and the unfortunate thing is that he had to find out, you know, when Aldo got hurt at the very last race of the season in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. And in some ways, he probably felt that he was vindicated, you know, thinking, okay, you guys do something like that, you're going to be, so they're going to bring you home in a body bag or something. And the worst thing was that the following year, when he found out that we were racing, he thought that we learned a lesson, you know. But, you know, actually, while Aldo was still in a coma, quite honestly, I kept whispering to him. I said, hey, Aldo, you know, I'm already building a new car to drive. You know, the doctor said, just talk to him about anything that actually would, you know, excite him. And that he, and that's what I kept telling him, you know, say, Aldo, yeah, don't worry, this is, you know, we're going to have a new car and all that sort of thing. In fact, when he actually, when it came around, the first thing he said to me, he said, I'm glad you had to be the one to face the old man.
Eventually, in Mario Andretti's career, of course, he would ascend to the top rung of the ladder in all aspects of auto racing, and eventually his father would warm up to that. As a matter of fact, Mario has told the story about finishing in his first race with his father in attendance and his dad wanting to know, well, why didn't you win, when Mario was thrilled with, say, a top 10 finish and knowing that he got the most out of the car. But in terms of his career, it would take in various forms and various levels between the different series that he would run, the different ownership aspects that he would get involved, and the different breaks that he would receive. Those are the things that we will explore, we will examine, and we will hear about in his own words when on this edition of Beyond the Bricks we continue hearing about the great Mario. And
in the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think out Outside the Box store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
Ready.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens higher Hensley. Tonight on Beyond the Bricks, we are talking about Mario Andretti, and we're letting him do it, actually. Mario Andretti in his own words. We talked about Mario Andretti as a young man coming over along with his brother, getting interested in the sport of racing. Once he began climbing that ladder and essentially, Mike, going through a journey that would put him in about every kind of car that one could race, the reality is that he drove for a number of different owners, particularly in the early years.
Well, when he was trying to get his foothold, you know, he was coming up and he got a break with a guy named Rufus Gray, and that was a huge break for him. Rufus Gray was a huge help to him getting noticed. And then when he got to championship cars, I mean, he drove for Doug Sturley's Sturley Motor Freight. That's where he made his championship debut. He drove the Windmill Trucker, Windmill Trucking Special for a guy named Lee Glessner. And that's where, you know, he got his feet wet a little bit in championship cars. And then finally, you know, that opened the door to get his big break, which was with Al Dean's team. And that was huge, because you think about the guys who have driven for Al Dean, you know, I mean, guys like Jimmy Bryan and Foyt and Eddie Sachs, and these are huge, you know, who's who. That was a huge opportunity. And what happened was a driver named Chuck Hulse had been the lead driver for that team, but he had gotten injured. And so they were looking for somebody, and Mario got an opportunity, and this was a huge chance for Mario to show what he could do in top flight equipment with guys like Clint Brawner and an up and coming crew chief named Jim McGee. It was just a perfect mix.
And one has to know that in the career of Mario Andretti, there have to be a number of different things he would consider honors or highlights. But to hear Mario Andretti talk about it, it is very clear that he was aware of his first opportunity with Dean Van Lines being an opportunity that was very special.
Well, I know that how I felt going in, you know, when the month started. I mean, the car wasn't ready. I just barely squeaked it in the last day of the rookie test. So there were a lot of things that actually had me on edge. But as soon as I, you know, the car felt like part of me right away.
was one of those blessed things, you know, that just happened. And just qualifying fourth. And we qualified on straight methanol. We didn't have nitro. You know, they wanted to be conservative because they want to have engine problems. You know, everything was so new. And if I would have 20% like everybody said, I think I would have probably might have been in the front row. You know, but nevertheless, you know, second row was fine. And again, you know, who am I following? You know, I'm the best of the best. But I felt that I had gathered enough confidence, you know, even with just the running that I had done up to that point that, you know what, I think I keep my nose clean. I think I should be okay. And, you know, we did have the issues that we had throughout the race was that from, you know, we had saddle tanks. And carrying a lot of fuel, almost 80 gallons of fuel. And what was happening is that we obviously had a common crossover, you know, to balance the fuel. But we didn't figure out the inertia because as I was using up the load, it was all going to the right side. So from mid tanks on, all the weight was on my right wheels. I was like on two wheels, you know, in a corner. So I had that issue, you know, to deal with. But nevertheless, you know, the car finished and we finished a good third, you know, behind Parnelli. I mean, you know, Jim Clark wins, Parnelli, Jones, and myself. So I was in good company, no question. And
I think when it comes to sponsorship, the business aspect of racing, Mike, there are few who understand it better than Mario Andretti or understood it better than Mario Andretti. And when you think about sponsors or partnerships with which he has been loyal, I don't know that any driver has been more loyal towards a manufacturer in terms of their contribution to racing than Mario Andretti has been to the Firestone Company. And just the loyalty that he has shown towards Firestone helping him win, especially at Indianapolis. But it is significant not just because of what they did for him, but also because that was, when you talk about manufacturing wars, if you will, that was as big as any back in Mario's early days, is that of the tire wars, Mike.
Absolutely. I think sometimes we forget how big the tire wars were in the 1960s. I mean, those two companies, Goodyear and Firestone, were pouring millions of dollars into the sport. And that was huge for the sport at that time. And that's also why we had, you know, some of the names that we had come over and do the 500. I mean, Denny Hulme, Jochen Rindt. You know, some of these guys, they wouldn't have been in the Indianapolis 500 if it wasn't for the tire company saying, you know, we want these guys in a seat and, you know, get them a prime seat, things like that. So there was a lot of money, you know, tire money in there. And so, you know, Mario, as you said, Mario was, you know, very loyal to Firestone over the years. And you know, he was very, as you said, a very astute businessman. And, you know, he was able to parlay his success into a lot of different opportunities, but the tire companies were very critical to that.
Mario Andretti, his recollection in his words on the tire battles of those days.
Well, I think tire war benefited in so many ways because the two giants of the industry invested so much into the development. And because of that, they brought a degree of wealth, you know, to the series, no question. And you know, they were making sure that the teams that they were relying on, you know, to obviously showcase their product were well-funded. And they were trying to obviously to arm themselves with the best drivers as well, and all of that, you know, financially, you know, had an impact. And to be part of all of that, I think it was very advantageous, of course. But you were hired to do a job, and I think we did the job for Firestone. I think Firestone was very happy with the performance that we were able to provide for them. But overall, as I said, yeah, it was great times for the sport. I think it elevated the sport, you know, to another level. And because of that, obviously, then other companies, you know, when they see the exposure factor coming on and the TV started coming on, it all snowballed, you know, to the commercial side really coming alive, which is, again, what that's what all professional sports are driven by anyway. But ours, you know, I don't know any other sport that's more expensive than motor racing, you know. So as you can see, you know, the more competitive it gets, the more you rely on sponsorship support. But all of that, as I said, just to continue to elevate the sport to another dimension. Then, of course, you know, the progression and computer coming on and all of that. But, you know, to be part of this, the progression on the technical side of the sport in every area, engine, chassis dynamics, aerodynamics. When I look back, I said, how blessed am I, you know, to have had that experience, to be able to tell the story as to where we were to where we are now. I totally understand where we are now, but I know where we were, and not too many people do that. And to be able to live and survive, you know, through all these decades. I mean, just totally blessed.
You know, it's interesting. In those early days, Mike, Mario Andretti was one that, you know, he won the national championship in his rookie season. He was still introduced nationally as the Rookie of the Year at Indianapolis, which is, you know, obviously both of those are great accomplishments. But yet, Mario Andretti was, I guess, somewhat irritated, correct, by all of that.
Yeah, he was a little bit chuffed, as they say in Britain, over that. He was a little irritated about that when he was introduced nationally as the Rookie of the Year. Not that he wasn't proud of that accomplishment. He was very proud he was the Rookie of the Year. But he was the national champion. He was the national driving champion in 1965. And he went on national television and he was introduced as the Rookie of the Year at Indianapolis. And, you know, he's kind of like, wait a minute, you know, I'm the national champion. So I asked him about that, and you'll hear that he was still a little bit irritated about that.
It was a perfect situation, actually, because Jim, being pretty much my age, is just, I think, a couple of years older than me. And but he was the modern crew chief, and Clint Bronner had the wisdom, you know, the old grouchy guy, but knew everything. And so it was a tremendous balance there for me, and I benefited from both, quite honestly. Jim and I just got on just beautifully, and again, you know, things were just clicking, that's all.
You told a story when you were at the Speedway a couple of weeks ago that I always enjoy, when you said you finished third and were Rookie of the Year in Indianapolis. You won the championship as a rookie, but when you went on Johnny Carson, they introduced you. Well, how did they introduce you? They introduced you as?
As the Indy 500 Rookie of the Year, which actually teed me off, because I was so proud, you know, that I won that. That was at the time, as you said, the youngest national champion. And I thought that was really the thing that was important to me at the time, and yet they considered the Rookie of the Year finishing third at Indianapolis was more important than that. So it brought home, I think, the fact that knowing how important the Indianapolis 500 is, actually, from a career standpoint.
Was that the minute you said? I mean, you'd already done the 500 at that point. You'd finished third, but is that the minute you said, "Now I know I got to have one of these.
I got to win it"? Yeah, so, you know, I think fortunately, your career is defined by your performance at Indianapolis, which is one race, you know, for a whole season. But you know, it's unfortunate for some of the great drivers that never, you know, were lucky enough to win it, you know, but it is what it is, you know. It's that's why it's you know, it's so important for us to be able to just really get that done, and that's what makes that that event what it is, you know. It's our, well, we always say, let's call it our Super Bowl, you know. It's just it defines your career in so many ways, because it opens doors for you. It's one motor motor racing, motor sports event that's known around the world.
Mario Andretti would win the championship in 1965 and 1966, nearly won it in 1967 and 1968, which just showed not only how good Mario was, we already knew that, but how good the team was as well. Oftentimes, people focus on the championships for a driver. Mario Andretti's thoughts on the near-miss championships.
You know, the way the point system was in those days, you know, you received 2 points per mile. So, you know, at Indianapolis, you got, winning Indy, you got 1,000 points. And all the other races were 100 mile or 200 mile or so. As you could see, you had to put together a string of a lot of wins, you know, to just equalize. And I, 66, like 60 and 67, I didn't get a single point at Indy. So to win the championship in 66, without a single point at Indy, that was to me what was, you know, obviously very satisfying. And in 67, I missed the championship by the narrowest of margins, you know, which I lost right at the very last race, which I ran out of fuel at Riverside, you know. So again, you know, our seasons were really going very well. 68, I finished second in the championship, and I didn't get a single point. I dropped out of the first lap at Indy, you know, with burned piston. You know, things like that. So we were competitive. You know, I with the Dean Van Line, with the and Clint Bronner and Jim McGee. You know, we were doing well. You know, and of course we I'll go back to capitalizing on everything that we were deriving from being, you know, one of the teams that developed Firestone tires with so much action and so much activity going on in that respect. You know, we were really on top of our game. And so that's why we were so competitive.
Eventually, Mike, Mario Andretti would wear the hat as well as team owner because of the passing of Al Dean. And while that was, I guess, probably somewhat a sign of where he had ascended within the sport of racing, Mike, the reality is, I think for Mario, that's not necessarily an era that he looks back on with the same level of fondness than he may have other areas of his career.
Oh, I think that's 100% right. And I mean, in 1968, he almost won the championship. He was jumping in cars, other cars, at the end of the year, in the last race, because, you know, his car dropped out. And so they had rules where you could just jump in someone else's car and earn points. And imagine that today. Imagine someone like Alex Palou, you know, getting out of his car because he needs points, and he jumps into, say, Colton Herta's car or something to try to win the championship. Can you imagine that today? But what happened was Al Dean had gotten very sick. And when he passed away, originally they thought that, you know, the team was going to continue, and that was his express wish, is the way Mario understood it. And it turned out that they ended up selling the team, and the team was going to be put up for sale and basically split up. And Mario, to basically save the team, had to step in as owner. But that wasn't a phase of his career I don't think that he wanted to do. I think he felt he had to do it.
Mario Andretti on owning his own team.
I want to ask you a question that maybe you have never been asked, but you briefly, after the passing of Al Dean, you owned the team. Was that a lot of extra work? Was that ever fun? I mean, in the book you kind of mentioned, it doesn't ever strike me as you had a lot of fun doing that. Was it fun at all owning your own team, or were you kind of happy to not have to do that anymore?
Well, the fact that I only owned it for 1 year, I will tell you the story. You know, it was something that I almost had to do at the time just to keep things going. And it was an easy transition. You know, I had to take on the reins, if you will, at the moment. But I didn't enjoy, because as you can see, even then, you know, I was moving around. I was, you know, even in 68, I even did my first Formula One race, you know, debut, and I was doing sports cars. I was doing a little bit of everything, you know, stock cars. And I wanted to move around. I didn't want to be tied down, you know, to my worrying about, you know, the team, everything. Is it all financed properly and all that? So as soon as I connected with Andy Granatelli, and I said, hey, you want to buy the team? He says, yep. I said, you got it. and so I got out from under it quickly and never attempted, never needed, never wanted to be a team owner again. All I wanted to do is drive.
The phase of owning his own team may be there now for Mario Andretti in terms of his career, but in addition to that, and in this era, Mike, what's going to become a huge part of his story, if you will, is the fact that he then got his opportunity with one of the most famous engines ever to roar across the Art of Bricks.
It's interesting that he had a chance to drive the turbine, and it just shows you a little bit about who Mario was as a person. He had a chance to drive in 1968 the turbine for Andy Granatelli. And what happened was that was the time he owned his own team, and he was driving. He had a sponsor called Overseas National Airways, and that was his sponsor. And he was offered a job by Andy Granatelli. He said, hey, jump in one of my turbines. And the turbines, don't forget, that year were, you know, on the pole and in the middle of the front row. So the first two spots were held by turbines. And Andy Granatelli said, hey, get in one of these cars. Mario had a chance to jump to that team, and that was quicker than the cars he was running. And Mario, you know, said, hey, you know, thanks for the offer, but no thanks. I'm going to stick with what we're doing. And that takes a lot of loyalty. I mean, he could have basically told the Overseas National Airways folks, hey, you know, this is a better car. You know, it's a better chance for me. I got to go take this opportunity. But that just shows you the loyalty Mario had. He stuck with his team, and, you know, obviously it didn't pay off. The turbines didn't end up winning either. But I mean, think about the fact that Mario could have been on the pole potentially in a turbine in 1968.
And in 1969, he would have to go to backup plans, so to speak. But it's safe to say that it all worked out for him. We will hear about that, continue the discussion, and hear from it in his own words in talking tonight on Beyond the Bricks about Mario Andretti.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Hey, all. I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center talking about Mario Andretti. At the end of the 1968 season, Mario sold the former Dean Van Lines team to Andy Granatelli. And for 1969, Mario, Graham Hill, Jochen Rindt all had brand new Lotus 64s. But Mario's was destroyed in a hard practice crash.
Yeah, I mean, the Lotus obviously was much more sophisticated than we had, you know, in our own ranks. And this is the reason why I did the deal, because we knew how well the turbine chassis worked, you know, the year before with a four-wheel drive and so on and so forth. And all of those features were there mechanically. But plus, we had some more advanced aerodynamics in this car, you know, typical what, you know, Colin was capable of. And of course, the new the Ford engine turbocharged double-AKM engine was already much more perfected. You know, in '69, the year before, it was brand new. So we felt we had technically on paper we had a really a superior package. And proof to that was that we were fast in practice. You know, I think it was between AJ and I, we were just trading, setting quickest, I mean, breaking records. records, really. And but you know, 3 days before the last day of qualifying, we had a hub failure, you know, sheared on the right rear during one of my practice runs, and I destroyed the car. You know, I just luckily I came away with just facial burns and so forth. But and then after examining some other issues they Colin had with Graham Hill and Jochen Rindt, they both had minor crashes, but through mechanical failures, they decided to withdraw those cars. So we had no spare cars, except the Bronner Hawk, which was built, you know, by Kuzma that year, which was a takeoff of the 68 Lotus chassis, and which, you know, that was the tub, and then the Brabham suspension of 66, 67. And that turned out to be, you know, obviously a darn good car, because never intended to race at Indy, but the only thing that was under design was a cooling system. And we had serious, serious problem at cooling the oil. Not as much of what, but the oil. But then when the oil temperature would go up, then the water temperature would go up, obviously. So anyway, so we decided to qualify without the outside oil cooler for aerodynamic reasons, never thinking that, you know, they were not going to let us race with the oil cooler, because you had to race with what you qualified. So we had that issue, and I figure, you know, they improvised. They put an oil cooler behind the seat, picking up air from underneath, exhausting at the top, which was very inefficient. But nevertheless, I think it turned out to be enough, just enough. And so with all of those issues, plus a right rear tire that wouldn't come off, thanks to Firestone, obviously that survived. You know, one thing that I didn't know for sure, but I was fairly confident that it was better for me to just keep going until if I saw, you know, something white there, if I saw cords, you know, I would have had to stop. But I didn't want to stop because I was competitive throughout the race. I didn't dare, you know, spend another lap and get a lap behind, you know. So we decided to keep going, and I ran the whole 500 miles, you know, on the same right rear tire, which was awesome. And the other things, the engines lasted, and all the things that we thought, here we go again, you know. But this was only the second Indy 500 that I finished after 65, and here we win it, you know. So very satisfying win for, you know, so many reasons, you know, to win it for Andy, for STP, and all that.
Mario would get in the STP oil treatment Hawk Ford for Andy Granatelli in the 1969 Indy 500, lead 116 laps, and ultimately win his lone BorgWarner at Indy.
And then in a race, I felt competitive because, you know, I put that thing on the front row after only 2 days of practice before qualifying, and I felt competitive definitely in the race, but I started overheating really early, and then I pretty much let AJ and McCluskey go by me. Then I was following, you know, fairly, you know, comfortably, and then I figured, well, I would just got to go for it and stay up there, and I feel no way I'm going to finish this race, but I just go for it, and, you know, just get as many, maybe a lap money as much as possible, you know, because it was meaningful, you know, in those days, you know, to put together some lap money, and all of a sudden, you know, I find myself still there at the end, and I had a good sizable lead on Dan Gurney, who was running second at the time, and meanwhile, Lloyd Ruby had dropped out. I had a good tussle with him, but I felt I had him handled. He probably felt the same, you know, and AJ dropped out, you know, again, all of a sudden, I figured, well, now I got to bring it home. So the last 15, 20 laps was really, really tough because I was hearing all the, you know, the rough things. And I was right because the gearbox was ready to fail. According to Jim McGee, you know, the, somehow we didn't have enough cooling for the gearbox. And when they opened it up, it was all dry. And he says the gears almost just fell out, you know, but it felt really rough. And but the blessing is that he brought it home and we won it. And I felt tremendous satisfaction winning it for Andy Granatelli, especially because of the efforts that he had made over the years, you know, just always thinking outside the box and coming there with, you know, with those turbine cars, almost winning it 2 years in a row and then dropping out at the end, big heartbreaks. And I was able to bring it home for him, the first time. And he had, you know, it started out, he would have had five cars in the race, five STP. He had three of his own and the two Lotuses, and had to withdraw all the Lotuses. So he had, you know, three of us, but we were able to bring it home and win it.
On the last lap, we always hear those stories. The winners tell us, you know, you're always listening for something. So you're really hearing stuff.
I was hearing the real thing. It was not in my head. It was there. My butt was really shaking, actually.
Mike, simply put, I don't know that there is anybody with their level of greatness that is more humble and enjoyable to speak with than Mario Andretti.
Absolutely. He's a joy to talk to every time. I've really been honored to talk to him every time I've had a chance to interview him.
And we're honored that all of you listen to Beyond the Bricks.
You don't wake up dreaming of McDonald's fries. You wake up dreaming of McDonald's hash browns. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.